Today is Wednesday, May 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Hong Kong police fired pepper pellets to disperse protesters worried about their future.
We're trying to safeguard our human rights.
Plus, for the first time, Twitter fact-checks the president.
Twitter invites users to get more context, saying the tweets had potentially misleading information.
And it looks like a go for today's SpaceX and NASA launch. We'll have those stories and more next. Hong Kong police fired pepper pellets to disperse protesters in the heart of the global financial center on Wednesday and arrested at least 240 people as national security legislation proposed by Beijing revived anti-government demonstrations. Now, to get to details on the day's protests, I spoke with journalist Ria Mogul, who's in the Asian Financial Hub, via WhatsApp.
About 300 people have been arrested today for taking part in an illegal assembly. Now, the protests were called, of course, because of the national security laws, but also because there was a contentious national anthem bill that was being debated at the Legislative Council today. So there were quite a few people that gathered, and a heavy police presence and multiple rounds of pepper spray were fired in retaliation as protesters attempted to gather in multiple districts in Hong Kong.
What is the legislation moving forward, the likelihood that it's going to pass?
So today was the second hearing of the national anthem bill. And of course, activists had asked for people to block LegCo to delay the reading of the bill. This is a tactic that was actually used last year when there was the reading of the ill-fated extradition bill. And because so many people had gathered around the building, lawmakers were unable to enter the building, and the bill, as we all know, was subsequently shelved. Today's tactics were a little bit different, however, and it's not unusual to see a change in tactics from protesters, because of course this is a very decentralized protest movement. It's not like the 2014 Umbrella Revolution, where we had a clear leader, Joshua Wong. This is big groups of people that manage things on social media and use Telegram to send each other messages. So these protests were supposed to kick off in the morning, and they never quite transpired in the way that they were about to, that they were meant to. Instead, there was just a heavy police presence outside the building, of course, learning from example last year. And police were conducting, you know, stop searches with journalists mainly, as well as other people that were passing by. And the bill did go to debate, and they were debating this bill inside the Legislative Council today. We don't have a hearing on when it's likely to be passed, but it probably will be passed in the coming weeks.
So where do things go from here?
Last year, we had the historic 1 million, 2 million strong marches. And it's important to note that those were actually marches that were authorized and they were approved by the police. They had a letter of no objection. Carrie Lam, earlier this week, said at a press conference that the new law would not erode the freedom in Hong Kong. But a lot of people don't believe her. A lot of people think that this is not true. And, you know, there's complete mistrust in the government. They don't follow what she says at all. And so the protests are likely to continue and will probably continue for a while, because we've got some key dates coming up as well. You know, June 4th is the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. July 1st is the annual pro-democracy march that takes place every year. So we've just got to wait and see.
Ria Mogul is a reporter living and working in Hong Kong. The Southern Hemisphere's first human trials of a potential coronavirus vaccine have started in Australia. 131 people aged between 18 and 59 are involved in the program in Melbourne and Brisbane. Phil Mercer takes things from here.
The potential vaccine NVX-CoV-2373 is being developed by the American biotech company Novavax. It started working on the drug in January when the COVID-19 outbreak began in China. It aims to boost the body's immune response and stimulate high levels of neutralizing antibodies. If the vaccine works, researchers hope 100 million doses can be made by the end of this year and 1.5 billion next year. Researchers say that vaccines are miracles and have a great way of protecting populations against these severe diseases. Dr. Paul Griffin is an infectious diseases expert who's involved in the Australian COVID-19 trial. He hopes the drug will successfully attack the virus and be ready for use within months.
We look for antibodies and the type and number of antibodies, and then we take some things out of the subjects through those blood tests and do a lot of laboratory experiments to show that it neutralises the virus. The company manufacturing the vaccine have already started that scaling up process, so they're already making a lot of doses of this vaccine. So if we can prove it's safe and effective, then potentially by the end of the year there'll be a significant number of doses available.
Australian authorities say the trial is a significant step forward in the global race for a coronavirus vaccine. Some participants will receive a placebo, while others will be administered Novavax's drug. Early results are expected in July, and scientists expect some conclusive results by the end of this year. Phase two trials would take place with thousands of volunteers in several countries. Volunteers are still needed, and the research team has stressed that no live coronavirus is used in experiments on people. Novavax has received $388 million from the Norway-based Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. There are more than 100 potential coronavirus vaccines in development, and about a dozen have made it to the human trial stage. It is a global race potentially worth billions of dollars to those who can find a safe and reliable treatment for a virus that has killed almost 350,000 people around the world. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The worldwide death toll from the COVID-19 pandemic has passed 350,000. The milestone comes as South Korea announced Wednesday its highest number of new cases in 49 days. Authorities are focusing on testing workers from e-commerce giant Coupang after dozens of cases were linked to a company site outside of Seoul. South Korea's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said all but four of its 40 new cases were in the Seoul area. The country was an early hotspot for the coronavirus outbreak, but now barely ranks in the top 50 in terms of confirmed infections, according to statistics compiled by Baltimore-based Johns Hopkins University. Brazil, on the other hand, has emerged as a major source of concern, trailing only the United States in the number of infections. On Tuesday, it reported the most single-day deaths in the world, with 1,039, its fifth consecutive day atop a grim list. India posted its record high of 6,000 new cases on Wednesday, pushing its total above 150,000. Mexico also reported troubling escalations in its coronavirus outbreak, with a new high of 501 deaths and 3,455 new confirmed cases. In the neighboring United States, governors continue to pull back on their lockdown orders, including in Nevada, where Governor Steve Sisolak announced casinos in Las Vegas can reopen June 4th, after the key industry was shut down for 10 weeks. He said, "We welcome the visitors from across the country to come here to have a good time, no different than they did previously, but we're going to be cautious." New Zealand also reported a new milestone in its coronavirus recovery, saying on Wednesday that there were no more COVID-19 patients in the country's hospitals. The European Commission presented its long-term budget for the European Union Wednesday. It included efforts to embolden recovery efforts from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 lockdowns and was supposed to lay down the framework for, quote, future and younger generations, end quote. Nicolas Pineau was in Paris, France, and I spoke to him via WhatsApp to get the details on the plan.
Yeah, it's a huge announcement because this European Commission, I just unveiled the plan. In dollars, it would be $826.5 billion as a recovery fund. So it's a major announcement made by the EU Commission president. Her name is Ursula von der Leyen. She spoke in front of the European Parliament. And basically, this help, you're going to have two sets of help. You're going to have a recovery fund and you're going to have loans. Basically, you're going to have some grants and you have some loans. And that's a mix of a solution of what Germany and France proposed earlier, and also some help asked by, let's say, Italy or Spain. So that's very, very important. And that's it's pretty huge. And in euros, you're going to have 500 billion given to the EU countries as grants, and the remaining 250 billion euros will be available as loans. And mainly, it's going to be money that's going to go to southern states. For example, Italy and Spain, the countries most affected by the epidemic, they will be awarded 173 billion and 140 billion, respectively, through this mix of grants and loans.
So what is the next step? Because this is just the proposal phase.
You're right. And the leaders, the 27 members, they're going to meet on June 18th to talk about what's next, to agree or to disagree on this proposal made by the EU Commission. You have also some reacts already after this announcement. You have, for example, the EU Economic Affairs Commissioner, Paolo Gentiloni, who says it's a breakthrough, a European breakthrough. And according to him, the fund will help tackle an unprecedented crisis. You have also some reacts made by Italy and Spain, the two main countries who would be, of course, on the front line to receive those funds. You have Giuseppe Conte, the Italian prime minister, who said it's an excellent signal from Brussels. You have also the Spanish prime minister, who said the proposal was a starting point for negotiation. And that's the key word right now, negotiation. As you know, in EU, everything has to be done unanimously among the states. So the 27 leaders, they're going to have to gather, and they're going to have this video conference by June 28th. They're going to come up with a deal or not. You know, usually it takes a lot of time, a lot of hours for European leaders to agree on something. And you have also to remember in the back of your head that EU, you have Germany and France, they're really pushing for mutualizing the debt. And you have also these four countries that we are called the frugal in Europe, Austria, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden, who oppose the idea of raising money on behalf of the European Union.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinault speaking to me from France. And coming up later in today's program.
That's really exciting, because that means that company, SpaceX, can also sell seats to other people. Like, maybe someday me, if I want to go into space.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Supernovas and gamma ray bursts have been considered by scientists to be the brightest explosions in the universe. Astronomers have found evidence that points to a new class of cosmic explosions called fast blue optical transients. The first was discovered in June 2018 when astronomers from around the world observed a flash of light they never saw before in the night sky. Studying observational data, two different teams of scientists have recently found two more explosions with similar characteristics of the first. One took place in 2016 and the other in 2018. The astronomers noticed that while blue optical transients had some of the same features of supernova explosions and gamma ray bursts, they also have their own unique traits. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. As Israel's new government plans to annex more than 30% of the occupied West Bank, the Palestinian Authority declared it will no longer adhere to any agreements with Israel and the United States, including one on security cooperation with Israel. Experts describe the two moves as a major obstacle to any future efforts to resume the peace talks between the two sides. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Khalil Jashan, executive director of the Arab Center, Washington, D.C., about the impact of the Israeli plan and the Palestinian declaration.
I think the action by the Palestinian Authority in response to the unequivocal declaration by the new government of Mr. Netanyahu to annex significant parts of the occupied West Bank will definitely lead to instability and will make the potential for a peaceful or political solution to the Palestine question even more difficult, more complicated, and more remote. It essentially depends on how this statement of frustration by the Palestinian leadership would be reacted to by the U.S. and by the Israeli government. It's a cry for help, if you will, to resume international political or legal and diplomatic efforts in the form of maybe a new international conference. That would be worthwhile. But if it does the opposite, I think it will be tragic for both peoples, the Palestinians and the Israelis.
What could the Palestinian declaration mean in practical terms?
In practical terms, it could mean many different things. If indeed the Palestinians succeed to get traction from their statement to hold an international conference on Palestine, that would be worthwhile. But it could go in the wrong direction. It could basically push the Israelis, particularly in light of some of the legal difficulties that Mr. Netanyahu is facing and the awkward hybrid government that Israel has that's very insecure. It could lead to the opposite.
Israel managed to gradually normalize relations with major Arab supporters of the Palestinians. Who would support the Palestinian rights after the U.S. dropped the two-state solution?
This has been the historic tragedy of the Palestinians. On the one hand, they have enjoyed universal and broad support worldwide with regards to their inalienable rights for self-determination and a state of their own. Yet at the same time, they couldn't secure long-term Arab support, their brethren's support, because of circumstances in the Arab world. At this stage, it looks to me like most Arab countries have resigned the Arab-Israeli conflict, focusing on the domestic concerns, particularly economics, and trying to deal with their own domestic insecurities and challenges. And the Palestinians can no longer depend on what used to be termed as the Arab debt. They get these lip service statements from the League of Arab States, then from the Organization of Islamic Conference, from summits, governments that keep declaring their commitments to the Palestine cause. Yet in practical terms, that doesn't seem to be leading anywhere because it lacks credibility at this time.
Khalil Jashan is the executive director of the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. He was speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawi. A Canadian judge will rule Wednesday on a key aspect of Huawei Technologies chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou's extradition to the United States. A ruling in her favor would be seen as paving the way for the release of the Chinese executive after 18 months of house arrest. British Columbia Superior Court Associate Chief Justice Heather Holmes will rule on the double criminality issue of the extradition case, deciding whether Meng's alleged actions were a crime in Canada as well as the United States at the time of her arrest. The ruling will be released at 1800 UTC. Meng was arrested in Vancouver in December 2018 at the request of the United States, which accuses her of bank fraud and misleading bankers about a Huawei-owned company's dealings with Iran. Meng has said she is innocent and is fighting the extradition. Swedish teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg has lashed out at the Danish capital because Copenhagen has for the last 6 years pumped large amounts of wastewater into the strait separating Sweden and Denmark. Danish media say that since 2014, over 35 billion liters of unfiltered sewer water has been pumped into the Øresund Strait during heavy rains because Danish treatment plants could not handle the large amount of water. The information has surfaced recently because the capital had planned to allow the Greater Copenhagen utility HOFOR to flush 290,000 cubic meters of unfiltered wastewater into Øresund starting Sunday. That decision has been postponed until October. Many cities in northern India are reeling under an intense heat wave, with the temperatures on Wednesday crossing the scorching 45 degrees Celsius marker. The temperatures in northern India are the hottest that the country has seen in decades for this time of year, and the hot spell is projected to last until Friday. For the first time, Twitter is flagging tweets from its most prominent user. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that story.
Even before taking office, Donald Trump talked up his use of Twitter to go after those he felt wronged him.
They hit you, you go bing, 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 bing.
He's largely ignored Twitter's rules, often tweeting abuse and amplifying misinformation.
You can't do the mail-in ballots because you're going to have tremendous fraud.
Under two tweets where the president railed against mail-in ballots leading to massive voter fraud, Twitter invites users to get more context, saying the tweets had potentially misleading information about voting processes. It's the first time Twitter's put sanctions on its highest profile user's account. The president responded with another tweet, saying Twitter's interfering in the presidential election and he will not allow it. His campaign chief says Twitter's clear political bias led the campaign to pull all its advertising from the platform months ago. Twitter itself had banned all political advertising last November. Sagar Magani, Washington.
President Trump tweeted on Wednesday, quote, "Republicans feel that social media platforms totally silence conservative voices. We will strongly regulate or close them down before we can ever allow this to happen," end quote. And finally, when NASA's space shuttle program ended in 2011, few thought it would take more than 8 years for U.S. astronauts to launch back into orbit from Kennedy Space Center in Florida. But as VOA's Kane Faribault reports, hopes ride high on a new space race of privately developed launch systems ushering in a new era of U.S. space exploration.
Even by using the tools at Chicago's Adler Planetarium, Director of Astronomy Geza Juke admits there's a limit to what he can see and do in understanding the cosmos.
We've got a 24-inch telescope in the back of the Adler. It's not a great place to do observing because of all the light pollution from Chicago.
Which is why he depends on experiments and equipment deployed by astronauts above Earth's atmosphere in the International Space Station to help him see not only the cosmos in new and different ways, but also the Earth from above. It's an important part of his work, limited since the space shuttle era ended, leaving the U.S. dependent on the Russians for a ride to the space station, and why Juke is excited to watch astronauts launch from the U.S. Space Coast in Florida, something he has not witnessed in almost a decade.
I'll look at one of the live streams and just enjoy the spectacle.
When astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley lift off, reach orbit, and then rendezvous with the International Space Station, they will do so in a system partially funded but not produced by Jim Bridenstine's National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Commercial Crew Program.
NASA is not going to purchase, own, and operate the hardware. In fact, we're going to be a customer. We're going to buy a service.
That service and hardware, a Falcon 9 rocket and Crew Dragon spacecraft for this mission, is supplied by SpaceX, the first of several private companies in a space race to regularly launch astronauts commercially from Cape Canaveral. The SpaceX Demo 2 mission got the green light to move forward, even as the world copes with the spread of the coronavirus.
We've been in, for all intents and purposes, a quarantine now since about March 15th. We have been in quarantine probably longer than any other space crew has ever been in the history of the space program.
While Hurley and Behnken's mission ushers in a new era of spaceflight, Juke points out it's also cheaper.
A shuttle launch was about $500 million. A partially reusable SpaceX is expected to be around $50 million. That's a factor of 10. And so cheaper launches means more opportunity for us.
Retired astronaut Nicole Stott says it also makes space more accessible.
I think the business model for any of these companies that are working right now in partnership with NASA, you know, the business model is going to depend on them having business outside of just NASA astronauts flying on these spacecraft.
It's a business model Juke hopes might lead to an opportunity to do more than just look at the stars from the Adler Planetarium on Earth.
That's really exciting because that means that company, SpaceX, can also sell seats to other people. Like, you know, maybe someday me if I want to go into space. And I just find that really exciting because that's going to open up space to everyone eventually.
While commercial companies focus on transporting space travelers into Earth's orbit and to the space station, NASA has not abandoned developing its own space launch and crew system. The agency is currently testing a next-generation rocket and capsule that will return astronauts to the moon and eventually take them to Mars. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Now be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.